Hello, welcome into this Monday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Mark Congleton here, your sometimes humble host for this hour of observation, insight, and yes, a bit of absurdity for this Monday, the 24th day of August, 2020. We're back from the weekend. Hope you had a good one and that all is well with you and yours. Around our house, we have a sickie in the neighborhood. My wife, Jane, is not feeling well. There's something that has been hitting in our area, has been hitting people who suffer from seasonal allergies and hitting them pretty hard. We've been going through the over-the-counter medications for that kind of stuff like crazy around our place. And I think I'm not a doctor and I don't play one on TV, but I do think that's pretty much what's going on. So I'll be blowing out of here probably in a little while to take her to get somebody to have a look at her and probably get some prescriptions and some shots and stuff to get her over the hump. Anyway, the weekend was just not much to it. Really, it was sort of a dull weekend. Nothing monumental happened for us. We didn't go anywhere, do anything exciting. I didn't even have any exciting finds. Well, I did find a nice little belt sander at a thrift store for $7. So that's one more in the win column for me, I guess. But over the weekend, I really kind of unplugged, except for sharing a few things on social media. And I'm constantly on that. I think I am. I think I should probably go into a 12-step program because I can't get away from it. But well, my insurance, somebody check. Will the insurance cover that? But I don't think it will. So that was pretty much it. The weekend has passed. It was uneventful. Jane had Friday off. So for us, it was like a 3-day weekend. And those are always nice because it gives us an opportunity to play a little, you know, to go do things and enjoy some time and just unplug for a little bit longer than normal. And that's good. That's always a good thing. And speaking of unplugging for longer than normal, if I can shift gears for a moment here, I've mentioned a couple of times we're planning a trip, and it looks like as the days go by, it's getting more and more certain that the first week of November, I'll be unplugging and taking at least a week off. And we'll be going somewhere. That somewhere not to be named until probably maybe that week, actually. I'm not going to talk about it, but I'm just giving you a heads up. I know it's a ways off, but I'm excited about it because it's been so long. It has been so long since we've been able to actually have a vacation. I'm getting kind of excited about it. Let's see. What else have we got here? We might as well go and drop into what we were going to talk about today. I've got a lot of stuff. It's funny. As I was compiling yesterday, it just didn't look like there was much to talk about today, because it's some days, just so you understand my perspective here, some days I look at the stories that are popping up and it's just the same old, same old. It's just more of the same. Everybody's talking about the same thing. And I try to look for things that have a different perspective, hence the daily perspective. And I try to present things from a different angle, and it's tough. And I look for stories from time to time. Every day I look for stories to pass along that are not what you're going to see pretty much everywhere. And that's really hard sometimes. But every now and then, the internet will hand you something just wonderful, like this story coming from the Daily Wire. HBO comic John Oliver is a despicable individual. He is a progressive. He is condescending. He is he's angry. He's hateful. And he plays it all up, wraps it all up as a comedy act, and does a news program that a lot of progressive people and a lot of my liberal friends watch, and they think he's a genius. Well, if he's a genius, then my dog designed the space shuttle. I mean, that's just how off the point this man actually is. And he picked on a specific town, and he had reasons for picking on this town, and it's come full circle on him. He attacked the city of Danbury, Connecticut recently. he was ranting. If you're going to forget a town in Connecticut, why not forget Danbury? Because, and this is true, F Danbury. Only he said the whole word. Oliver then cited its charming railway museum, its historic Hearthstone Castle. And then he sniped, Danbury, Connecticut can eat my whole bleep. He added, if you're from there, you have a standing invite to come get a thrashing from John Oliver, children included, F you. Well, over the weekend, on Saturday, the mayor of Danbury, he's a Republican, announced on Facebook that they would be renaming the city's sewage plant. The new name is the John Oliver Memorial Sewer Plant. Quote, because it's full of crap, like you. This is what he said. He stood in front of the plant, and he had this to say. Hi, I'm Mayor Mark Boughton of the city of Danbury, Connecticut. You know, last week, John Oliver had us on his show, and he pointed three important points of interest of Danbury. One was our wonderful railway museum, and we agree with that. Two was our great castle. We certainly agree with that. And then three was that we once were ranked as the number two city in the United States of America. And of course, we agree with that. But today I'm proud to announce our fourth point of interest. Behind me, you'll see the city of Danbury sewer plant. We're going to rename it the John Oliver Memorial Sewer Plant. Why? Because it's full of crap, just like you, John. And oh, by the way, thanks for showing that Amazon video. We did get Amazon here in Danbury. You see, John Oliver recently discussed jury representation in America on his show, which is called Last Week Tonight. Here's what he said. In Connecticut, and in most of their jury selection computer program, it accidentally read the D in Hartford to mean deceased. Please remember this. This is a computer glitch he's talking about. So for nearly 3 years, it never summoned anyone from Hartford, or indeed New Britain, the second largest city in that district, because their list of names had been accidentally misplaced and was never entered into the computer program. And the thing is, these two missing cities accounted for 63% of African Americans in the district and 68% of Hispanic population, which is horrible. Of course, John Oliver is referring to racism. He says, because if you're going to forget a town in Connecticut, why not forget Danbury? Because, and this is true, F Danbury. From its charming railway museum to a historic Hearthstone Castle, Danbury, Connecticut, can eat my whole assular area. I know exactly three things about Danbury, he patronized. USA Today ranked it as the second best city to live in 2015. It was once the center of the American hat industry, and if you're from there, you have a standing invite to come get a thrashing from John Oliver, children included, F you. Well, the Boughton's reference to the Amazon video apparently derived from a 2017 video in which Oliver mocked Boughton and other mayors for videos they had released in order to lure Amazon to locate a headquarters in their cities. In his video, Boughton asked the home assistant, Alexa, where the best place for the facility would be, and Alexa said, Danbury. So John Oliver is referring to, because he's making this horrible, you know, this horrible claim of racism, and because
everything is racist,
a computer glitch is now evidence that the people of Danbury, Connecticut are racist. Thanks, John. Way to really hit the point right on the head, buddy. Everything is racist in Danbury because there was a computer glitch. It was an error. And not entering populations from certain cities, clearly a human oversight. Things like this happen. Things like this happen. So it can't be just a mistake. It can't be just an oversight. It has to be racist. It has to be evil racism in the eyes of progressives. Because progressives see the whole world through victimhood. Everybody's a victim, and if everybody's a victim, then somebody's got to be the bad guy. And the bad guy, in the eyes of progressives, is always the conservative. And that's the way John Oliver sees the world. He doesn't see it from an even perspective. He doesn't see life fairly. He sees everything through the twisted, weird lens of progressivism. And so, everybody's a victim. Well, John Oliver is a victim of his own idiocy. And as a result, he now has a sewer plant named after him. Attaboy, John. Good for you. That's just absurdity at its finest, actually. And I love that it came back to bite him. And something has also come back to bite some other people. A school district in Tennessee is facing some criticism. Why? Because parents there were asked to not listen in during their children's online classroom time. In Murfreesboro, Tennessee, the Rutherford County Schools asked parents to sign a form agreeing to give teachers privacy with students. The district soon came under fire, retracted its stance, asking parents not to listen to what their children were being told during virtual classes. Parents are no longer being asked to stay away from participating in the educational experience of their children. School District Communications Director James Evans told Fox News. He said this, "We're aware of the concern that's been raised about this distance learning letter that was sent to parents. We've issued new guidance to principals that parents can assist their children during virtual group lessons with permission of the instructor, but should refrain from sharing or recording any information about other students in the classroom. Roughly 20,000 of the district's 48,000 students are learning from home. The controversial letter asking parents not to listen in on those home learning lessons is the second time in recent days educators have asked for privacy while speaking with kids at home. Earlier this month, a Pennsylvania teacher named Matthew Kay complained online with other teachers that distance learning would prevent him from speaking to kids about subjects such as diversity, gender, and sexuality. Matthew Kay wrote on Twitter, "So this fall, virtual class discussions will have many potential spectators, parents, siblings, etc., in the same room. We'll never be quite sure who's overhearing this discourse. What does this do for our equity inclusion work? How much of students depended on the somewhat secure barriers of our physical classrooms to encourage vulnerability? How many of us have installed some versions of what happens here stays here to help this? While conversations about race are in my wheelhouse and remain a concern in this no-walls environment, I'm most intrigued by the damage that helicopter-slash-snowplow parents can do in honest conversations about gender-slash-sexuality." He added his chief concern was conservative parents overhearing his discussions with their children. Other teachers also shared Kay's viewpoint and complained that virtual learning would hinder their ability to discuss social issues with kids. One teacher who chimed in on Kay's now private post, which has been archived, get the show notes for the link. You can actually look at it for yourself. One teacher wrote, "In my district, we already had a white parent record their child's Zoom meeting and file a complaint against the teacher for an anti-racist read aloud, saying the teacher's commentary was inappropriate and biased. It's going to be an issue for sure." Another self-described teacher added to the discussion, quote, "I'm also worried about kids who are out at school but not at home. What happens when another parent hears them referred to by their preferred name / pronouns and shares with the parents?" This is what happens when we, you and I, as parents, grandparents, when we allow unionization to control what happens inside the walls of the school. What's happening is progressive ideology is being taught to our children and our grandchildren. That the progressive thought has taken control in classes. And as you can tell from the comments of teachers here, these particular progressive teachers, I should add, is that these teachers would really prefer that parents not be involved in the educational process because They see parents as a hindrance to the furtherance of their progressive goals. How can they freely teach the children progressivism and shape their pliable little minds to their mindset when their conservative parents step in and say, "Oh, no, you don't"? And I would dare say that this is happening in more places than just Tennessee and Pennsylvania. You should check where you live and see what's happening where you live and find out what's really going on and what they're really teaching your kids at school. Welcome back to the Daily Perspective Podcast for this Monday, the 24th day of August, 2020. Yeah. It is, I haven't looked, but it looks kind of gray outside. We had thunderstorms and stuff over the weekend as well. And we got really soaked, really soaked. I did manage to get the little car out over the weekend, though, Saturday morning, and drove it around. Still having a little bit of an issue with it, and I'm still trying to sort it out. Burning a little oil. It's 30 years old, for Pete's sake. And I've never had the engine really rebuilt, so what are you going to do? I'm trying various things. We'll see how that pans out. Anyway, moving back to things to talk about today, looking through my list of things, and I this popped up this morning, and it's a story that I saw yesterday. And I thought, well, what do they know? You know, it's coming from a source that you just, if you don't question her validity or her veracity, then you don't have a brain, because she's proven that she doesn't have a good grip on reality. Okay. And here it is, coming from Daily Wire. On Sunday, Atlantic correspondent and former ESPN host Jemele Hill, now you know who I'm talking about, suggested the United States was as bad as Nazi Germany, adding that the slaughter of 6 million Jews was a learned behavior from Germany. Watching America. Quote, been reading Isabel Wilkerson's new book, Cast, and if you were of the opinion that the United States wasn't nearly as bad as Nazi Germany, how wrong you are. Can't encourage you enough to read this masterpiece. So she posted to Twitter. Jemele Hill has routinely ripped President Donald Trump, calling the commander-in-chief a bigot and a white supremacist. Even after blowback, the former sports writer refused to apologize for her rhetoric, saying on a radio program that calling Trump a white supremacist is the same as saying water is wet. Politico, she was immediately, by the way, hit with backlash. Former acting director of national intelligence and ambassador to Germany, Rick Grenell, said, read a book. The Nazis murdered 6.5 million Jews. Matt Walsh over at the Daily Wire said, been reading Jemele Hill's tweets. If you were of the opinion that she's smarter than a cactus, how wrong you are. Author and psychology professor Jeffrey Miller posted a Twitter poll. He ripped into Hill. His poll says, is this one of the top 10 worst takes in the history of Twitter? The answer options on his poll were yes, no, but it's pretty bad, and not at all. This is fine. Just the basic fact that you have a huge platform, make a solid living bleeping on the president and haven't been locked in a labor camp, says this is the complete opposite of Nazi Germany. Grow up. So said Tim Young on Twitter. The remark promoted Hill to note that she believes the U.S. was as bad as Nazi Germany, though it is not currently. She said, nowhere in my tweet did I say the current state of America is like Nazi Germany. I was referring specifically to our racial history. Did you get that? Our racial history. The parallels have been pointed out by plenty of historians, and not just Isabel Wilkerson. You tell me to grow up, I say you need to read more. And I can answer that. If you do read more, you'll find historian after historian after historian, all of them credible historians, by the way, have debunked what is in this book she's referring to. They've said it's. Do you remember the story about the sewage plant? Yeah, it belongs with John Oliver. Yeah, When faced with criticism from ARC Digital Editor-in-Chief Bernie Belvedere, Jemele Hill doubled down on a remark suggesting Adolf Hitler took a page from America. He commented, "This is breathtakingly irresponsible. How is anyone supposed to trust your judgment after this horror show of an opinion?" She shot back, "What would you call it when a country that murdered millions of Jews learned their systems of genocide by watching America and studying our history of racialized slavery and a great knack for racial terrorism?" You see how twisted this woman is? Her brain is deeply and deeply damaged. Back in May, she took to social media to defend Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden, a 77-year-old white male, over his comments regarding black Americans who, according to Biden, weren't actually black if they haven't already decided to vote for him in November over President Trump. She wrote on Twitter, "The issue wasn't what Joe Biden said, because it was accurate. The issue was that it came from Biden. It also was clearly a joke that didn't land, but I'm wondering where all this outrage was yesterday when y'all president declared his public devotion to a Nazi sympathizer." She later doubled down, "I don't have a problem with the statement because he was clearly referring to this from a policy and track record standpoint. If you're black and you support anti-black policies and positions, then that makes you what? You're still technically black, but you ain't with us." You know, if you know your history, then you know that in one sense, the Nazis did learn something from America, but it wasn't what she's talking about. You see, she's wrapped up all of this racism and this evil, when the track record of America actually shows that those who were evil towards black people, those who were pro-slavery, those who saw these human beings as property, like furniture or cattle, rather than people. These people were all Democrats. And they were willing to divide the country in two and go to war to protect their interest in keeping people as property. Yes, I know that's an oversimplification, but it all boils down to it. And yes, I know. Oh, states' rights. You know what the states' rights issue was? The states' rights issue was that some states were no longer reporting escaped slaves and sending them back to slavery. That was the states' rights issue. It centered around slavery. Back to Nazi Germany. The chief propagandist for Nazi Germany was a man named Joseph Goebbels. He actually did learn a lot about propaganda from watching progressives in American politics. If you study your history, you'll find that Goebbels watched how American progressives lied to the people to get what they wanted and thought it was brilliant, and actually applied some of the principles he learned from American progressives as ways to convince the German people to go along with what Hitler wanted to do. So Jemele Hill is wrong about racism. She is wrong in everything she says. But she unwittingly is right that Nazi Germany did learn something from Americans. But they learned something from American progressives about how to lie to the people in order to persuade them to go along with what they wanted to do with and to their country. Jemele Hill can't be expected to actually learn and accept the truth because she has made up her mind. It's that old joke, don't confuse me with the facts, my mind is made up. You're never going to confuse Jemele Hill with the facts. You just aren't. She is convinced that she is right, because in her mind, victimhood is what everything is about. It doesn't matter that she's actually making a good living. She made a good living with ESPN before her mouth got her in trouble. She's working for the Atlantic now. She has a job that a lot of people would be envious of. She's making a decent income. She's doing what she enjoys doing. And yet, for some reason, in her mind, this isn't possible for a lot of people because they're victims. Well, she's managed to prove that wrong with her own life. And yet, she still continues to point fingers and assign blame for the failure of progressive ideology in America on people who are not progressive. Her hatred drives her, just as does the hatred of progressives in government today. Their hatred for anything which goes against the grain of what they believe. Please don't forget that progressives like Jemele Hill firmly believe that they are intellectually and morally superior to anyone who doesn't agree with them. They believe they're smarter and they care more, and that you can't possibly understand what they understand, which is why you need them. You need them because you are too dense to understand what's really going on. So we have to have people like Jemele Hill to show us the way. It's a classic case of the blind leading people they believe to be blind. Welcome back. It's the Monday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast for August 21st. Well, Joe Biden was on the news last night. I don't know if you saw this. And in an interview with ABC News, he and Kamala Harris were interviewed last night. Joe Biden says he'd close the country down to stop the spread of the coronavirus if scientists recommended he do so. He also said he wasn't really in favor of defunding the police. Interesting. He said, I'd shut it down. I'd listen to the scientists. That's what he told ABC's David Muir in an interview that they taped last Friday. He reasoned that the key to reopening a country's economy is first gaining control over the virus and its spread. He knocked President Trump for failing to realize that, that's what he called a fundamental flaw of the administration. Interesting. let me move forward before I get sidetracked. He said, I'll be prepared to do whatever it takes to save lives because we cannot get the country moving until we control the virus. That is the fundamental flaw of this administration's thinking to begin with. In order to keep the country running and moving and the economy growing and people employed, you have to fix the virus. You have to deal with the virus. ABC's Robin Roberts, in a separate interview, asked Biden if he wants to defund police departments, as Donald Trump claims he does. No, I don't, he responded. By the way, Trump proposes cutting $500 million out of local police forces. Look at what the police need, first of all. There has to be a national standards that, in fact, applies to every police department in the country, and that's what we're going to do. Wow, that's very interesting. He also said, if anything, police departments need more assistance. And more assistance means more progressive control on a nationwide level. When he says that there need to be national standards, he's coming from a very progressive viewpoint here, because progressives believe that all government should be centralized, that these police departments should answer to the federal government rather than their local governments. There need to be national standards that apply to every police department in the country. And I would say, no, I don't agree. I really don't agree. I believe that there should be national standards with regard to how the states relate to each other regarding police work, yes, but there should not be national standards on how police manage things in their own metropolitan areas, in their own areas generally speaking, because we are not all the same. Life in tiny town Alabama is not the same as life in New York City. Life in coastal resort area Florida is not the same as it is in Seattle, Washington. It's different. The pace of life is different in each of those areas. Viewpoints about certain social things are different in each of those areas. What's acceptable and not acceptable to the public, to the people, is different in those areas. And when you seek to homogenize it all and make it all the same, you're guilty of applying a one-size-fits-all solution, which is classic progressivism. Classic. You can't do that. Now, back to coronavirus. What Biden is talking about, closing the country down, we've learned from closing the country down that it didn't work because it was a one-size-fits-all solution, because every place is a little different. How people socialize is a little different from place to place. How things work socially is a little different from place to place. And applying the same standards to rural areas as to metropolitan areas is wrong because of the differences. And if we did what Joe Biden is suggesting we do, then Georgia and Florida would still be locked down as they were before. But they're not now. And their new case totals are falling and the death toll is falling. You're not hearing about that in the progressive press because they're focused on the horrors, how terrible things actually are, how devastating this disease, this infection, this virus actually is, when the fact of the matter is that we're not only over the hump, we're well over the hump. But people like Joe Biden are just saying what they need to say to get votes. And it's a shame. He would shut the country down, close the country down to stop the spread of coronavirus if scientists recommend he do so. Well, even scientists don't agree. We've seen that happening again and again. Man-made climate change is a really good example of that, where government-funded scientists are all on the page saying, oh yeah, it's dangerous, we got X number of years. And then others who were studying the data are saying, well, wait a minute, that's not necessarily true. And who do the progressive politicians quote? The ones who are being funded by progressive politicians, of course. And in this case, we've seen the difference of opinion. Dr. Anthony Fauci, for example, I've told you before, he is a worst case scenario guy. He looks at situations and says, yeah, well, this could happen. And he's talking about, well, if we don't, for example, do you remember not too long back, actually just a few weeks ago, when there was talk about, oh, now we're all going to have to wear goggles? That was just an aside, essentially, by Dr. Fauci. If this happens, then this could happen. And if this happens, then this can happen. And then you extrapolate that to worst case scenario. And well, if this continues this way, we could all probably benefit from wearing goggles to avoid getting the disease. And what is the news media report? Dr. Fauci says we'll probably have to all start wearing goggles. He's Mr. Worst Case Scenario. He doesn't filter things like he should. And of course, his unfiltered responses get reported as doomsday prophecy by the press. And Joe Biden is talking about listening to the scientists. Well, there were other scientists who disagreed with Dr. Fauci on all of this. President Trump has just appointed one to the panel, to the people, to the group of people who are delivering the information about the coronavirus and what's happening. So now there's some actual balance. He needs Dr. Fauci. He does. He needs that input from that perspective. He also needs input from another perspective. He needs the balance there so that he can see, he can get a general picture of what things really are instead of just this one-sided view he was getting from Dr. Fauci. Now, would Joe Biden listen and actually heed someone who says, listen, we don't need to lock down? If we lock down, the mental toll on people, specifically children and the elderly, who can't have social contact with people, that takes a toll. It would be terrible. You're going to see suicides increase. You're going to see drug abuse increase. You're going to see alcoholism increase. You're going to see marital issues increase if we lock people up. And that's exactly what happened when we stopped letting people go places and do things. Those things happened. So would Joe Biden listen to people say that? You can't do these things? It's going to be bad for people if you do? Or would he, under the influence of his progressive advisors, opt for the doom and gloom, worst-case scenario side? I think you know which side he would take. Because only one side makes him look more like a hero, coming to the help of the American people. And that's the view, that things are bad and something has to be done. Something drastic. So Biden would shut us down again, destroy our economy. And Biden wouldn't have a clue about how to fix it afterwards. Because he's never had a real job. He's lived off the people his entire professional career as a politician. He doesn't know how to fix an economy. He just knows how to repeat the theories of people around him. Biden is not the guy that should be in the White House. Not at all. Biden represents the darkness, the gloominess, the negativism that we saw last week for four straight days during the DNC convention. He's a good example of it. He's a politician. He knows how to smile at the camera. He knows how to deliver a line. But he doesn't know how to fix things. All he knows is that the experts say this. The scientists say that, so we're going to do that. He doesn't know how to repair anything that's damaged. All he really knows how to do is damage things. Because that's what politicians do. As I said last week, they propose programs to fix problems which were created by previous politicians who proposed programs to fix problems. It's a never-ending snowball that gets bigger and bigger and bigger because more politicians propose solutions to fix problems which were created by the solutions of previous politicians. It's a never-ending cycle. And it benefits them because they get to keep making money off of you. They get to keep their houses and their cars and their investments, while the rest of us have to start selling things off just to buy groceries. They're detached from real life, so they can't fix real life. It takes someone with prior experience in real life to do that. And it just so happens we have somebody like that in the White House right now. And he has been fixing the problems. He's not getting any credit for it from the progressives in the mainstream news media, but he is fixing the problems. Because he has actually had to earn a living. He has actually run companies. He has had tremendous success and a lot of respect from the news media and people on the progressive side of the aisle, until he decided to run for president as a Republican. The guy who can fix the problems is already in the White House, and it's up to you and me to keep him there for four more years. Time to jump into the final segment of this Monday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. And I'm looking at I've got two stories here. I'm flipping a coin. All right. Okay, let's go this way. We'll touch on this one and we'll jump into the other one. How about that? One of Barack Obama's apparent points of frustration has been President Donald Trump taking full credit for overseeing the strongest U.S. economy in decades. This is coming to us, by the way, from the Federalist paper. Randy DeSoto is the author. However, during his remarks at the Democratic National Convention Wednesday night, perhaps unwittingly, Obama opened the door for his successor to take full credit for the economy going into the November election. Before the COVID-19 outbreak, the United States was enjoying its lowest unemployment rate in 50 years, 3.5%, along with strong economic and wage growth. In fact, wages were growing the fastest for the lowest earners, and at a rate not seen in over a decade, thanks to the tight labor market. According to a report from the Washington Post, which is not a Trump-friendly publication, they reported that back in January. The unemployment rate is poised to drop remarkably from a high of 14.7% in April into single digits this month. 9.1 million jobs were added from May through July. On multiple occasions, Obama has tried to take at least some of the credit for the Trump economy. In a September 2018 speech at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, Obama said, "I mean, I'm glad the economic recovery continued, but when you hear of this economic miracle that's been going on, when the jobs numbers come out, monthly job number, suddenly Republicans are saying it's a miracle." I have to kind of remind them, actually, the job numbers are the same as they were in 2015 and 2016. He also, in February, tweeted, "11 years ago today, near the bottom of the worst recession in generations, I signed the Recovery Act, paving the way for more than a decade of economic growth and the longest streak of job creation in American history." He appeared to be referring to the Great Depression of the 1930s when the unemployment rate reached over 25%. When Obama took office in 2009 during the Great Recession, unemployment peaked at 10%. President Ronald Reagan, a generation or so before Obama, faced an even higher 10.8% figure during a recession in the early 1980s. But no need to quibble. Both presidents grappled with major economic challenges. The difference is Obama oversaw the worst economic recovery from a major recession since World War II, and Reagan oversaw the best. By raw numbers, Trump was staring at numbers not seen since the Great Depression, with an official unemployment rate of 14.7% this past April. CNBC estimates the actual figure is closer to 20, by the way. Obama placed all the blame of the job loss on Trump during his DNC convention speech, saying Donald Trump hasn't grown into the job because he can't. And the consequences of that failure are severe. 170,000 Americans dead, millions of jobs gone, while those at the top take in more than ever. You see, he's got to fan the flames, stoke the fire of class envy, because that's what progressives do. So Trump's responsible for every job lost due to COVID-19? Okay, well, never mind. It was the governors of individual states that decided whether and to what extent to shut down their economies because of the coronavirus outbreak, and how quickly they'd open back up, but okay. Not surprisingly, in an election year, the Democrat-led states, by and large, had the most severe shutdowns and have been the slowest to reopen. It's neither here nor there now because Trump owns it all, according to Obama. That means he also has to take full credit for what's turning into the quickest recovery on record. The unemployment rate is heading toward single digits in August. It reached 10.2 last month. The robust recovery began in May when 2.5 million jobs were created. That caught analysts completely off guard. It set an all-time record. June shattered that benchmark with 4.8 million jobs added. The trend continued in July with another 1.8 million. One reason the economy's been bouncing back so quickly is all the fundamentals were in place. After taking office, Trump made four very un-Obama-like moves. He cut government regulations on businesses more than any president in U.S. history. He signed tax cuts for businesses and individuals into law. He promoted domestic energy production, and he negotiated new pro-America trade deals. The first year after the tax cuts were implemented, economic growth shot up to 3% in 2018, And it fell back in 2019 to 2.2%, which can be attributed, at least in part, to tough trade stands Trump took against China that led to a deal. Additionally, the Federal Reserve tightened the money supply and raised interest rates. You remember that. They were working against him. The last year Obama was in office, the GDP grew by a paltry 1.7%. So it was Trump's economy, even if his predecessor didn't want to admit it. Now, if Obama wants to place all the blame on Trump for the COVID-19 shutdown job losses, he has to officially accede. He has officially acceded, I should say, the ground to the 45th president to receive all the credit for the recovery. If he's going to give him all the blame, he's got to give him all the credit. He won't. But he should. So the economy is recovering, regardless of what the mainstream press is trying to tell us and the lying progressive politicians are trying to make us believe. Things are recovering, and they will get better. Now, moving on to the other topic, let me see if I can get through this really quickly. Kevin Sorbo, remember he was Hercules in the TV series? He posted on his Facebook page over the weekend something that I want to pass along to you. It says, I've done my best to respect the diverse opinions regarding COVID-19 over the past few months, but I have these nagging questions about it. This sums up my train of thought. Please just take the politics out of it and read this with an open mind using common sense. Anyone out there who can tell me what our end game is with COVID-19? What's the magic formula that's going to allow us to sound the all clear? Is it zero cases? The only way that'll happen is if we just stop testing and stop reporting. Is it a vaccine? It took 25 years for a chickenpox vaccine to be developed. The smallpox inoculation was discovered in 1796. The last known natural case was in 1977. We have a flu vaccine that's only 40 to 60% effective, and less than half of the U.S. population choose to get it. And roughly 20,000 Americans will die of the flu or flu complications. Oh, you'll mandate it like other vaccines are mandated in order to attend school, travel to some foreign countries, etc. We already have a growing number of anti-vaxxers refusing proven, tested, well-known vaccines that have been administrated for decades but aren't necessarily safe. Do you really think people will flock to get a fast-tracked, quickly tested vaccine whose long-term side effects and overall efficacy are anyone's best guess? How long are we going to cancel and postpone and reconsider? You aren't doing in-person school until the second quarter? What if October's numbers are the same as August's? You moved football to spring? What if next March is worse than this one was? When do we decide quality of life outweighs the risks? I understand COVID can be deadly or very dangerous for some people, but so are strawberries. So is shellfish. We take risks multiple times a day without a second thought. We know driving a car can be dangerous. We don't leave it in the garage. We know the dangers of smoking, drinking, and eating fried foods. We do it anyway. We speed. We don't buckle our seatbelts. We take more than directed. Is hugging grandma really more dangerous than rush hour on the freeway? Is going out with friends after work riskier than four-day-old gas station sushi? Or operating a chainsaw? When and how did we so quickly lose our free will? Is there a waiver somewhere I can sign that says, I understand the risks, but I choose a life with hugs and smiles, and the state fair, and concerts, and homecoming? I understand that there's a minuscule possibility I could die, but I will most likely end up feeling like crap for a few days. I understand I could possibly pass it to someone else if I'm not careful, but I can pass any virus on to someone else. I'm struggling to see where or how this ends. We either get busy living or we get busy dying. When God decides it's your time, you don't get any mulligans. So I guess I'd rather spend my time enjoying it and living in the moment and not worrying about what ifs and maybes. And I bet I'm not the only one. And I think that's well said. He admits he copied it from a friend and passed it along. Encourages readers to do the same. And I think it brings up some good points. We have a flu vaccine that's only 40 to 60% effective, and less than half of the U.S. population will choose to get the flu vaccine. I actually went for years upon years upon years without getting the flu vaccine. I worked around people who got the flu vaccine every year and got the flu. and I never got the vaccine and never got the flu. 20,000 Americans are going to die of the flu or complications from it. The smallpox inoculation was discovered in 1796. Nearly, well, it was 180 years later before the last natural known case was found and taken care of. 180 years it took. It took 25 years for a chickenpox vaccine to be developed, period. Watch carefully, because what's happening right now is the vaccine is being pushed on us. That's the line. That's the line we have to cross. We have to have a vaccine. And then they'll move that goalpost again. That's what will happen. They'll move the goalpost again to no more cases until we wipe it out. Remember, it took 180 years to wipe out smallpox. How long are the politicians willing to keep us in lockdown mode? Scared of our own shadows and frightened of people who aren't wearing masks. How long? The answer to that question is as long as they can. That's it for today, friends. God bless you. Have a good Monday for the rest of it. Let's get back together tomorrow for the Tuesday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. I'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.